This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. On the program today, we'll talk with Ed Feigenbaum, who's the editor of Indiana Gaming Insight and Indiana Legislative Insight, about, among other things, the new first-year revenue figures out from the casinos around the state, including Northwest Indiana. We'll also find out anything interesting in politics, and plenty of it here in Indiana and elsewhere. And that, and of course, another conversation from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University is coming up, as well as an update on housing prices here in Northwest Indiana, conversation with Peter Novak with the Greater Northwest Indiana Association of Realtors. That and more coming up here on Regionally Speaking. Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio, I'm Chris Nolte. Let's take a look at the action from Northwest Indiana's and all of Indiana's casinos here in recent months. And for that, of course, another news Sue will cover on the legislative and the political scenes here in Northwest Indiana and the rest of the Hoosier State. Ed Feigenbaum is the editor of Indiana Gaming Insight and Indiana Legislative Insight, and he's joining us from his office in Indianapolis. Ed, thanks for being with us today.
Hey, great to be back with you, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Thank you. Let's take up the issues involving gaming. It's been relatively quiet, I suppose, at the casinos, except they, of course, reported their latest casino revenues figures. And the latest issue of Indiana Gaming Insight, which is available in subscription, by the way, mentions with a headline, half full and not half empty for once. Tell us how the six-month casino revenues seem to be shaping up around not only Northwest Indiana, but the rest of the state.
Well, a little bit of historical perspective here, Chris. You know, when we started out the year, I think we even talked in early January about how this was probably not going to be a good year for the casinos on the northern tier along Lake Michigan. Yeah. Because the Pokagon Band of Potawatomi Indians was going to be opening their Four Winds Casino in South Bend. So everybody was expecting a significant decrease in gaming revenue northern tier, particularly at Blue Chip Casino. And that simply has not happened. Yes, there has been a decrease, but it's in fact, Boyd Gaming Company, which owns the Blue Chip Casino in Michigan City, which is most directly affected by the casino next door in St. Joseph County, just held an earnings conference call about 10 days ago, and they said, hey, we're increasing our earnings guidance for the second half of the year because, let me tell you, things have not been as bad as we thought, and we've been able to make some kinds of different improvements at the property that have attracted visitors, and we've also been able to cut expenses, and we're competing effectively against the Native American tribe. Uh-huh. And that's been the case for all of the other casinos in Northwest Indiana. And we've also seen an increase in the southern tier casinos as well, even though they faced some flooding problems that closed three of the casinos for a few days during the end of the first quarter, beginning of the second quarter. And so things are really looking up for the state, and it looks like we're going to end the year with another increase. And that would be 3 years in a row with an increase. Yes, it will be marginal, but considering that we came into the year expecting that there would be a few percentage point decrease, and I think that this is very positive news.
Now, I know that you also, besides the Indiana casinos, keep track of what happens over in Illinois and even over in Ohio because they're the border states and their casinos are competing with ours here. How did we seem to do compared to the ones that are closest to us there in Illinois?
Well, Illinois casinos are having a real tough time. They are struggling, with the exception of the what we call the category killer, the Rivers Casino in Des Plaines, which is always now outpacing Horseshoe Casino Hammond, which had been, you know, as everybody joked, the mother of all boats.
Right.
But with the exception of the Rivers Casino, the other nine Illinois casinos seem to be struggling, and a big reason for that. The principal reason for that is because Illinois now has almost 30,000 video gaming terminals, and those are scattered across the state in more than 6,500 different establishments. Things, you know, as everybody knows from scuba diving establishments to, mom and pop retail stores. So if you've got a number of different options for people in Illinois, and a lot of those Illini are staying home, staying, just down the block and not going to their casinos, whether they're in the Chicagoland area or in, Metropolis, Illinois, or on the Iowa side of the state. Mm-hmm. So Illinois casinos are having a tough time. The Ohio casinos are kind of holding their own, but the Ohio casinos are being outpaced by the Ohio racinos. And that came as a big surprise a year or so ago to most people once they got all the racinos open there. And, the racinos in Ohio are not quite like the racinos in Indiana. The Ohio racinos are limited to a different kind of slot machine that looks like and resembles a real slot machine, but it isn't quite the same thing. So they're competing at a disadvantage, but still outpacing the traditional in Ohio.
And you also know, too, that taking a look at the Ohio casinos, I guess, with the increase in revenue over there, what kind of impact has had on the casinos here in Southeast Indiana? Because they're the ones that are competing the most directly with them.
Right. There are three casinos in Southeastern Indiana that are part of what we call the Cincinnati, and those are Hollywood Casino Lawrenceburg, which is now a sister casino, or will soon be a sister casino, I should say, to Ameristar Casino in East Chicago, because the corporate parents are going to be the same. So you've got Hollywood Casino Lawrenceburg, you've got Belterra Casino Resort, which is currently a sister property to Ameristar, but will not be after a couple of new sales that are coming down the pike. And then you have the Full House Resorts Casino, which is Rising Star Casino Resort in Rising Sun, Ohio County, the state's smallest county. Mm-hmm. And those three casinos have been severely hit. Hollywood was kind of the equivalent of to Casino Hammond until Horseshoe really opened. Hollywood had been the big casino in the state of Indiana, and had really dominated the Western Ohio market as well. And they were really badly hit when the Cincinnati land-based casino opened, and that Cincinnati casino opened actually under the Horseshoe imprimatur, and it has since been sold to a different company. But the revenues in the Cincinnati from real heights by about 30% over the years. And, this is really since about 2012 when the first land-based casino opened in Cincinnati. They've been kind of, retreating a bit and holding their own. They've reached a level of equilibrium, and I think each is at the point where, okay, they figure we've got a better understanding of what our baseline revenue can be, and let's work toward making sure that our properties are right-sized for that revenue, that we're not overspending. We know our market. We're targeting specific kinds of gamblers. We know we can't be what we were before, but we're okay today. And some of them are trying some innovative things. The state's smallest casino, the one in Rising Sun, is going to be opening a ferry August.
Right.
They will be opening a ferry soon, probably in the next 2 weeks, that will be ferrying visitors over about 10 cars per trip from Rabbit Hash, Kentucky, across the Ohio River to Rising Sun. And they say that, cutting out about 50 minutes from a commute from that part of the state, which is extremely populous in greater northern Kentucky, with the Florence area and the greater Cincinnati airport, they believe that they've got an opportunity to start bringing in more customers there and raise their profile and help them better compete.
That's so great. That's great.
Ideas are generating different business.
We're talking with Ed Feigenbaum, who is an editor of the Indiana Gaming Insight and Indiana Legislative Insight. And you also have in the latest report, too, a look overall at how with the topic that we've talked about recently on sports wagering is coming along. And I know that there's some reports that are supposed to be due out, I guess, to tell us more about how this new intruder into the gaming industry is doing.
Yeah, we're going to be convening an interim study committee, a legislative interim study committee that will be looking at the sports wagering issues. The legislature in the final days decided that was something that needed to be done, as it looked like the Supreme Court was going to be overturning the federal ban. And so I think we're going to be getting some indication as to a framework that legislators would like to use as they approach this topic in the next set. That we reported on in the last issue, not the most current issue, the last issue of the newsletter that's probably of interest to people in Northwest Indiana is the issue of charitable gaming as well, Chris. Mm-hmm. And, as you recall, back, 20, 25 years ago, charitable gaming in Northwest Indiana was huge. The bingo operations, particularly in Lake County, this was something that was really sought in terms of legislation to legalize this charitable gaming activity, something that was sought by a guy by the name of Chet Dobus, who had been a longtime veteran legislator for Maryville. Mm-hmm. And Dobus was instrumental in getting this through, and Northwest Indiana took advantage of it. And in the early years, particularly as before and then as the casinos were growing, charitable gaming was a real growth industry in the state of Indiana, but over the last several years, it's really taken quite a hit. But for the full fiscal year of 2017, the Indiana Gaming Commission finally issued a report back just 2 weeks ago, 2.5 weeks ago, on the fiscal year 2017 numbers, and the charitable gaming numbers are down yet again. They've been down in 8 of the past 10 fiscal years, and the most current year, that fiscal year 2017, they're down to their third lowest level in more than 20 years. So we're way down. We're down by about 30% from the all-time peak year performance, which was back in fiscal year 2000. Which, as you remember, was before all of the casinos opened in the state. So even as commercial casinos are expanding their operations and they're extending their revenues, we're seeing a hit being taken in charitable gaming revenues as a result.
And let's switch over from gaming into looking at politics here, and we know that this is the midterm elections, and we have for this year certainly a lot of attention is being paid to the U.S. Senate race in particular, and the efforts by incumbent Joe Donnelly to keep his seat, and all the pressure against him for whatever reason coming from the Republicans, even though they're not only trying to kick him out, but they're also too trying to, I guess, to get him to fess up, I guess, one way or the other, how he feels about the U.S. Supreme Court nominee. So there are a number of things out there, a number of polls, I guess, that have come out recently. How do the candidates in the U.S. Senate race, from what you can tell from your vantage point there in Indianapolis, seem to be shaping up?
Well, it's fascinating that a lot of the ads on TV already are from third parties, from all these different groups that you don't know who is behind them on either side. Mm-hmm. Some saying that Senator Donnelly should vote to confirm Judge Kavanaugh. Some saying that he should vote to oppose Judge Kavanaugh, and using different kinds of rationales. And Mike Braun is out there, suggesting that Senator Donnelly, first of all, take a meeting with Kavanaugh, and once Senator Donnelly did that, became the second Democrat to schedule a meeting with Judge Kavanaugh. Mike Braun took full credit for it. He said, "Well, I forced him into doing it." Yeah, that's probably not the case. I think a meeting was most likely in the cards, and a pretty quick one anyway, because Donnelly does not want to be viewed as not giving someone a chance and not looking like he's being fair after that's the way that he's kind of set himself up in the campaign so far. But Donnelly's going to be under a lot of pressure, particularly after he voted to confirm Neil Gorsuch, the president's last nominee for the Supreme Court. And it's going to be difficult for him to oppose this nominee. There may be a realization on the part of Senate Democrats that Judge Kavanaugh is going to be nominated regardless. Rand Paul seems to have dropped his opposition, and there will be a pretty united Republican front. And if the reality is that Kavanaugh, you know, cannot be stopped, I think that Joe Donnelly is a little bit more free to take the position that he should be confirmed and vote to confirm him and take some political benefit from that as well as the Democrats look toward the broader game here, which is, you know, Democratic control of the Senate in 2019 and beyond, and being able to stop any other Trump nominees, if there may be any, in the way for a change in administration in the next presidential election. But at the same time, you know, Mike Braun is going to be out there saying, well, I forced Joe Donnelly into voting for Judge Kavanaugh. He didn't want to do it. He didn't want to oppose his party. And he's going to make it clear that Joe Donnelly, a Democratic majority, if that's the case, that would oppose any further nominees. And again, you're going to have the battle lines drawn as a result.
Well, I'll tell you, Ed, we're going to take up the issue of politics again because we know a lot more things have happened. We didn't even have a chance to even delve into the issue of Curtis Hill, the attorney general, who is under fire for his personal actions and the allegations against him. And I know that the investigation from the Indiana inspector general is still underway. So I guess we won't really know much until that complete report is coming out here. We'll have to take it back together again and talk about this in a bit more detail. So we thank you for being with us today, though, Ed. Ed Feigenbaum is with Indiana Gaming Insight and Indiana Legislative Insight newsletters based in Indianapolis, and we'll have you back on to talk again real soon. Thanks very much today.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Our next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversation to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
Music's always been a major part of my life. My parents, there was a theater in Chicago called the Regal Theater. And when I was growing up, as early as 2 years old, I can remember going over to the Regal and seeing people like Duke Ellington and Count Basie and Sarah Vaughan, all the top jazz people as I grew up. We lived upstairs on the second floor of my godmother's house. The piano actually was given to me by another godmother that I had. So we got the piano, and my mother said, well, you'll be taking piano lessons. Okay, you know. But the piano was on the front porch where I could look out and see everybody running up and down the street playing. So the deal was that I was going to practice every day for an hour, no matter what. And this friend would come over, and he'd be sitting there because he wanted to go out and play. And I can remember him saying, can you hurry up? You know what I'm saying? There's no way to hurry up an hour. It is what it is. I tell people now, you know, I've never seen anybody make a dime playing hide and seek. Eventually, I grew to love it. You know, I'd be at the piano for 4 hours and not one. I really didn't actually learn how to play jazz until actually I got out of college and started rubbing elbows with other people who actually played the music, and I learned from them and kind of on the job training, really. I had a trio, then I had a quartet, and then I formed a band that had five pieces. And at that time, there were about 30 different clubs in Gary where you could go from one spot and play, and the next weekend you could play someplace else. And we would actually, on our breaks, run from one club to the other to listen to another guy play and then come back and play some more. So that's really how this all got started. The thing is about jazz is that we have access to it. There's some things that some minorities don't even have access to. The symphony was something that we didn't have equal access to. You know, so you couldn't prove your mettle there. But jazz, you always could. It's one of the, I guess, racial forerunners in it, because there've been mixed bands since when? Whether you're white or black, once you hit the bandstand, then you're on your own. If you can play, you can play. If you can't, you know, you can't. And it's obvious to everybody. And I guess it's the same way in sports. It's an equalizer. Once here at the university, we played with a guy named Red Rodney. He was a white guy that played with Charlie Parker. He was telling us the story of when they went down south, he had red hair, kind of a light complexion. So they billed him as Albino Red, you know, because the mixed bands couldn't travel the south. When Duke Ellington went south, he rented a set of Pullman cars, and the guys would just travel the south. They wouldn't do hotels. Blacks couldn't stay in the regular hotel, so they worked off of the Pullman cars. Well, there's a jazz musician named Clark Terry, and he had played in this band that used to go down to Carroll, Illinois, and my mother used to see that band. And he played in Duke Ellington's band for about 9 years, and so I was riding in the car with him, and I was saying, I know you used to play in Eddie Randall's band, and you guys used to go down to Carroll and play. And he said, oh, yeah, that's that city where the guy came up on the bandstand and cut Duke Ellington's tie in half. Those are the kinds of things that used to, you know, can you imagine a man of Duke Ellington's stature having something like that happen? My take on the whole thing is that all of the races on the planet were put here by God. All of us have different takes on things. If everybody would work together, you know, my strength might help you and your strength might help. It's like a puzzle. All the pieces of the puzzle can't be the same. You know, they have to be different. The differences are really a strength. I don't see why you would want to be by everybody that's just like you. If everybody were like me, it might be kind of sad, you know. I need somebody that plays the saxophone. I don't need a bunch of piano players.
You can find more regional stories online at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. The deadline to reunite immigrant families separated under the Trump administration's zero tolerance policy has come and gone, and hundreds of children are still reportedly in government custody. Indianapolis Public Radio reporter Drew Dawdlin sat down recently with Congresswoman Susan Brooks to ask what she knows about the situation and to talk about her recent trip to the border.
I'm interested in talking to you about the visit. You visited the border, I guess, in early July?
I did. Second week of July, on a Monday, I did an all-day tour down in Brownsville, Texas. We visited with the CBP, Customs Border Protection, to see where they were kept. And so we were at a CBP facility initially, which is where we see the fencing. And it's a very, very large facility. And families were kept together there that we saw. This is a short-term facility. Before they are then moved, and we went to one of those facilities, we went to what was called Southwest Key, and a facility in Brownsville, where I saw 1,379 boys in one massive facility, a super Walmart that had been converted into like a big campus. Those boys, most of them are there without any adults.
And of course, there were a lot of reports they were not going to meet the deadline, that there were probably hundreds of families that were not going to be reunited in time. What have you heard about the reasons why that didn't happen?
So we were told these reasons initially, and then a number of members from the committee just went to what was called the Special Operations Center, which is like a command center in Washington, D.C., of the different agencies involved in the reunification. The challenges we have is that some parents were deported and are back in their countries, and now we either need to try to locate them, which could be difficult, or we also had parents who said they did not want to be reunited. It's so hard for any of us to even imagine that, but we have to remember all of these parents who brought their children here or who sent their children here without them are trying to provide a better life for them, trying to get them out of the horrific gang violence and the poverty in those countries. Then there are a group of people, HHS and our government, looks at and tries to determine the criminal records of the people who say they are parents. That's a different issue. And if there are any red flags that come up, they're doing DNA testing, which takes a little bit of time to get those results.
So it sounds like you get the sense that a significant amount of those that were not reunited yet, there were justified reasons from the government to not get it done
well,
in time?
The government is indicating there were justified reasons. I think the bigger challenge is probably with the group that were deported, that were already deported while their children were here.
And so obviously there's a lot going on. This is a complicated thing. But
it is.
If you had full control over the entire situation and unlimited resources, what would you do tomorrow to not fix it immediately, but get it on the right track?
We actually do need to continue to provide more resources down at the border. We need more people down at the border. We need more facilities at the border because we don't have enough facilities and people to handle the massive numbers that are coming to the border.
Do you think that's going to happen? Because this is obviously, this controversy has happened a little while ago at this point.
It absolutely
has. So the problem is evident.
And I'm very disappointed because I voted on an immigration bill that did add significant $25 billion of future funding, current and future funding for border security, which includes some wall, some fencing, more technology, more people, more infrastructure to support our massive problem at the southern border. We need to be compassionate. We need to be fair. It needs to be efficient. But I think if people saw what I saw and what people down on the border know, the massive numbers that come have simply overwhelmed our capabilities.
I'll let you go.
Okay.
Thanks so much
Thank
for talking.
You. Thanks, Drew.
That's WFYI Public Radio reporter Drew Dodlin speaking with U.S. Representative Susan Brooks. Well, we haven't talked with Pete Novak from the Greater Northwest Indiana Association of Realtors for a while, and most of the information we get, of course, is about home sales. But let's talk more about not only the most current figures on home sales for the month of June here in Northwest Indiana, but a little look at the 6 months that we've now at this point across 2018. Pete, thanks for joining us here on Regionally Speaking today.
My pleasure, Chris. Thanks for having us.
Well, let's first get the data that we have handy here on the number of homes here in Northwest Indiana in the seven-county region that the Association of Realtors covers for the month of June. How did the home sales seem to turn out?
Well, again, this year, and in June, you know, you're going to see a little bit of choppiness with the monthly home sales. So that's sort of the situation we're in right now with an inventory shortage. It just really depends on if buyers are finding what they're looking for. We remain in a market where demand is high for housing. It just really depends on if something is available for the buyer that they like, they're going to move on it. And in some cases, prices are rising so fast, we have some buyers just getting priced out. So that would be a little bit of a reason for some up and down. If we looked at the six-month total, it's probably exactly how I would have pictured the market coming into the year.
Mm-hmm.
Very modest growth in terms of closed home sales and a pretty sizable jump in terms of the median selling price. I think that's kind of what the market has been for the last couple of years, so no surprise there.
I know that looking just at Lake County alone here, they did pretty well at the 686 housing units that were sold in June. Increase from what was sold this time last year, and an even bigger jump, I guess, going from between May and June is the big jump that we noted here, the 19% or so, almost 20% increase in between May and June. Is that because of, I guess, the time of year, the fact more people were out there looking?
It's partly that, and again, we've been a little bit in a choppy market for the last couple of years in terms of inventory. So, you know, when we look at the year-over-year comparisons, it could be possible that the month we're looking at, the current month, just was an amazing month, or it could be that the previous year's month was not a great month. And all that is just a matter of timing. And again, you know, it's just a situation where we know buyers are out there looking. It's just a matter of whether they're finding what they want. So this year so far, we've seen some pretty good jumps in Lake County, you know, both in terms of what happened in June and just really on the whole year. Lake County's been pretty solid. Same thing with Porter County. You could look at and see very similar numbers, maybe even better numbers on the Porter County side. But then you might look at some of the rural counties and see a little bit of slowdown. But to me, again, that just all just is a timing issue. you know, we have high demand and it continues to be that kind of market, and we probably see that remaining for some time here.
And I know we've talked in past months and even years about this too, and you mentioned it's always seems to have been the same, that we have this incredible increase in the demand for people wanting to go into housing, to change houses, to go from bigger houses to smaller houses, and then you've got the question of whether the inventory is out there, whether there are enough houses that people can buy that they happen to like, and we find it's sometimes pretty tough to be able to meet the demand, I would imagine, and we're in that case now, I guess.
Yeah, it is. It's some people might be confused, and when we say, well, the demand's continuing to grow, it's not necessarily growing. It's staying really high. What's happening is that we're actually getting less listings coming on the market. Sellers are just not choosing to sell, particularly in a market where they know demand is high. You would think oftentimes sellers might attempt to capitalize on that. We're in a market where there's rising prices. There's obviously plenty of potential home sellers out there who might like to capitalize on the equity that they've gained in their home, but for a variety of reasons, they are not putting their house up for sale. And there's no one particular reason, but probably a combination of reasons, at least based on the input we're getting from our membership out there. But that's really the situation. Each month that we've been tracking, we can see inventory declines, and it's really been happening since probably about 2014. And just what I guess we've been holding out hope for is that we'll start to see that change. We'll start to see more balance. We'll start to see more listings hit the market. It'll cool prices a little bit, which wouldn't be a bad thing because, like I said, we want to be gaining on pricing. But at the same time, if you rise too fast, well, I think we know how this story has ended before. And then also you have buyers who are just really getting priced out, particularly on the low end where they're trying to get into the housing market, but they just, you know, it's so competitive that they just can't really find what they're looking for either. So I think ultimately we hope that's the way the market goes. I will say it's been surprising that it's been this way for as long as it has been. But I guess we just have to wait and see.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Peter Novak, who is the CEO of the Greater Northwest Indiana Association of Realtors. And we've had this good luck in sales through the region here in the month of June. And it's compared well to recent months. And it's always the case, too, Pete, isn't it, that we talk about the demand, and the fact is that the demand is out there and people are looking for houses. And it's still pretty tough to find new houses, too. More contractors are building more houses here in Northwest Indiana, but it's apparently not enough to meet the demand.
Yeah, no, they have not. And if you actually talk to the builders, which we do from time to time, and things are going well, I'm hearing a lot of very positive things. And, of course, we're building more today than we were a year ago or even the year before that. But at the same time, you're right, it's still not at the point where it is satisfying demand. So, you know, that market is a little bit constrained as well, just in terms of what they're able to produce and what buyers are out there seeking. So certainly that's a part of it also.
Mm-hmm. Now, looking ahead to the rest of 2018, you mentioned that it seems to be holding steady and then have improvements as well. Do we see the improvements not only in sales, but also in what the median price for these homes that are sold will be?
Yeah, again, it certainly is a guessing game. I would guess personally more of the same throughout the rest of the year. There's certainly some individuals who start to look at the housing market and go, okay, you know, we're starting to see a slowdown. What's happening? Are we looking to have a turn here? And yet, let me say also, you know, we've really seen a pretty solid run here. Prices have been rising since about 2012 overall. So, I mean, that's a good solid six-year run. And, you know, that may happen in the future also, but I think it just really depends on who you ask. And this market is quite a bit different than, you know, the market we had in the mid-2000s, Chris. And one big thing of note is specifically the inventory levels, which is what we're talking about.
Right.
You know, if you compare the inventory levels now versus what they were in the mid-2000s, they look entirely different. We had much more supply then. And when the market crashed at that time, that left us with a lot, you know, home sellers with a lot of supply that, really the only thing that they really could do if they really had to move was slash the prices. That's not this kind of market. Again, if demand went away tomorrow, it certainly would be a bad thing for the market. But one positive note of that would be we wouldn't really be stuck with a ton of supply because we just don't really have any. So definitely different markets, and it remains to be seen what the future holds, and only time will tell. But I think we'll continue to feel pretty positive about the housing market, at least for the near future.
Now, let me ask Pete, you have a chance to talk with your colleagues at other realtors organizations around the state of Indiana. What are they telling you about their particular regions? Are we all pretty much in the same boat, so to speak?
Yeah. It's a national issue, yeah. No question, and it has been for quite time. So, you know, some areas obviously are a little bit better than others, and, you know, again, when you talk about some of the really hot markets out there across the country, that's even more of an issue for them. But, you know, again, it is a national issue, and it's not necessarily particular to Northwest Indiana.
Well, so it certainly seems that you would think in places like Central Indiana, where we have a lot more people moving into some of the surrounding counties around Indianapolis and going into these other counties and looking for homes, and they're probably have the same big demand for places out there and the same tight supply as well.
Yeah, it is, no question. The hotter markets definitely get that, but I get asked that question often, Chris, and I'll tell you it's just as competitive in Hammond, Indiana, and Whiting, Indiana, and some other places as well. So it's not necessarily the newer, growing communities that are having that issue. You know, again, it's really across the board, and I'd look at some of the communities that I mentioned and others also here in Northwest Indiana that have that same issue. It's not necessarily in our area. If we were looking at the St. John's and the Crown Points and the Valparaisos, mm-hmm. Certainly it's an issue there, but it also is an issue in some of the places I mentioned as well.
Now, one other thing, too, we always talk, of course, more about single-family homes, about duplexes and the like. How about the bigger units that are out there? We see a lot of new construction out there, I guess, and not necessarily in apartments, but I guess they are being built out there, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, we are seeing new developments in general, you know, and particularly on the rental side. You know, rental prices have been high also throughout this same time that the market's been really well, and more importantly, just the economy's doing better. Banks, I think, are looking at you know, a little more ways to be more lenient and get involved in different projects, and so, you know, both, you know, in terms of some of the commercial stuff we're seeing out there, and also just even the single-family developments or the townhome developments and things of that nature, all of that is definitely doing a lot better than it was in the past, and I think we'll see more of that in the future also.
Well, sounds like good news for realtors and good news for people that are looking to sell homes, and just a little tougher for people trying to buy homes, even if they're trying to downsize a bit, too. They're out there looking for, you know, in a tough market to find the homes in, but we're working our way through it, apparently. Thank you very much, Pete, for talking about this, and we appreciate the comments and the insight, and we will be checking back with you again.
Sounds great, Chris. We appreciate you covering this as well. Thanks.
Peter Novak is the CEO of the Greater Northwest Indiana Association of Realtors. Going to find out more about plans by the Gary Sanitary District and the Stormwater Management District to seek out Gary-based contractors to work on projects. We have with us the Director of Compliance and Project Engagement for the Gary Sanitary District and the Stormwater Management District, Tammy Davis. Tammy, welcome to Regionally Speaking.
Thank you, Chris. I'm so happy to be here with you.
If you will talk a little bit about the Sanitary District for folks who may not be familiar with what the district is all about, and the fact that you have not only the Sanitary District but also the Stormwater Management District under your purvey. Tell us a little bit about the agencies first.
Absolutely. Yeah, so the Gary Sanitary District, it is a wastewater treatment plant. We process sewer and wastewater. So we have a combined sewer system, meaning that both of those factors flow into our pipes. So that sewer water as well as wastewater. So we strive to be environmentally conscious, environmentally focused, and we process sewage and wastewater not only for Gary, but also for Hobart, Lake Station, and Maryville communities.
How long has the district been in operation? But probably almost about as long as the city of Gary's been in operation. I
almost. Yeah. I think we actually started in like 1938 or something like that. So we've been around for several decades, and we've gone under a number of improvements, both at our lift stations, within the community. Some people may have seen like the big, large cylinders, you know, where we are helping to ensure that there is adequate flow throughout our sewer systems. So we've been around a long time and have been quite progressive.
When you talk about the Sanitary District seeking out Gary-based contractors, maybe we should mention, first, what are some of the projects that the Gary Sanitary District and the Stormwater Management District are undergoing this year?
Sure. I'm very proud to announce the partnership that we have with the Army Corps of Engineers. We have done a number of projects through them, and most of that has been through funding that Congressman Pete Visklosky has been able to obtain for us through grants called the 219 grants. Mm-hmm. So we're very happy to have that partnership because many of the projects cost millions of dollars. And so it's through these partnerships and these other funding opportunities that we have those partnerships. So, for example, one of the projects that we're doing with the Army Corps of Engineers is the Lake Street Sewer Separation Project that's going on the Lake Street area in Miller, in Gary. They being with the Army Corps, another project, finished on 32nd and Broadway. It was a flow modification project that we had going on. And so right now, there is a project. It's located on 29th and Jerry Street. Currently, it's on hold, but that project will be coming up online relatively soon. We have projects going on Clark Road. There's another one, a street drainage improvement project that is coming on 4th and Bigger Streets in Gary. And on the stormwater side, we have a project going on at 5th and Montgomery.
When you set up the projects within the sanitary district, most of them, I guess, primarily involving handling stormwater as well as trying to separate the sewers, I suppose, because I know that's in many, many cities has been the big problem, trying to deal with not only sanitary waste going into the sewers, what normally people would consider, but also you've got the stormwater overflow. And we know here in the city of Gary that's a problem trying to keep the sanitary district equipment handling just this regular sanitary waste as opposed to whatever comes down whenever we have the rains.
Right. So, as I mentioned earlier, we have a combined sewer system, one of the oldest probably in the state, if not the country, to the point where we have both sewer and wastewater coming into the same pipes. So we do have the risk of what's called a combined sewer overflow. And that just really happens when we have a heavy rain. That's, you know, not much that we can do about it. But the projects that we have going on throughout the community helps to address some of the challenges that we face in having a combined sewer system. And so as we have these projects that go on in our communities, we want to make sure that the contractors that will bid on and ultimately work on the projects are as conscious of the community as they are with the environmental concerns that we have in our city.
Tell us what work has been done already in getting contractors, and particularly ones that have workers at least companies that are based in Gary to be able to work on these projects.
Absolutely. So when the Gary Sanitary District goes out for a bid, we ensure that in the bidding documents we include the policies and practices that we would expect the contractors to adhere to relative to identifying local, meaning Gary, contractors and Gary construction workers. We hold pre-bid meetings where a majority of those I attend to reiterate the importance of having local Gary contractors, suppliers, as well as construction workers.
How difficult has it been to be able to get people involved in the process that are basically based in Gary, have employees based in Gary?
To some degree, Chris, it has been challenging because we make sure that not only do we place the requirements in the bidding documents, but we reach out to the schools, we reach out to the churches. Last year, we held the Northwest Indiana Compliance Forum. And as a part of that forum, we had a Gary resident trade fair where we put flyers all over the community. We sent press releases. You know, we went everywhere scouring around the community to get Gary residents to come to the trade fair so that our contractors could meet them. right, and begin to build their own individual database of Gary residents who work on the projects. But as contractors are submitting their what's called their certified payrolls to me to review, I'm consistently seeing a decline of Gary residents. And so that's why I sent out the email blast, because I need some assistance in identifying Gary residents that are either already a journeyman or are an apprentice, so I could get them in front of our contractors.
We're talking with Tammy Davis, who's the Director of Compliance and Project Engagement for the City of Gary's Sanitary District and the Stormwater Management District. They're together. They're also separate as well. And you've mentioned about the fact that you've been looking for Gary-based contractors on the projects. Have you had much luck, I guess, in getting in back any of the email blast so far?
Actually, we have. I have seen a few Gary residents to respond to that email. I have someone that's a plumber, electrician, a carpenter. And when I go back into the office to check my email, I hope that there will be more. We do have some local Gary contractors that have responded with our procurement registration form to identify themselves. We know they're out there, but we want to make sure that we're making ourselves accessible and approachable to those. So anybody out there, here's my plug, Chris, before you ask me. We need Gary contractors. We need Gary suppliers. We need Gary construction workers. So if you're out there, if you know of anyone, please have them to contact me. May I leave my telephone number and email address?
Yes, go ahead.
They can reach out to me via email at Tammy, T-A-M-M-I, at GarySan, that's GarySan.com. My number to the office is 219-944-0595, extension 1824. We need plumbers. We need operating engineers. We need carpenters. We need cement masons and some laborers. We really need those in the skilled trades, if you will. So if you're out there, let me know who you are.
Is this a,
we've got work for you.
Is this a problem or an issue, I suppose, that is more exclusive to the Sanitary District or pretty much all of Gary City government?
It's a challenge throughout the country, actually, and, mm-hmm. and Gary is not alone. There are a number of surrounding communities that have a local hiring ordinance similar to Gary, but not the same. East Chicago has one, Hammond, and I believe Michigan City has a local hiring workforce. But it's a challenge, I believe, for all communities that's trying to find local residents. But then when we get into looking for minorities and women, that number gets even smaller. And so we, and speaking with the number of the trades, their challenge now is that they have a number of union workers that are retiring. And they need to, you know, repopulate the books with the next generation of construction workers. So it's a regional challenge, Chris. It's not just specific to Gary, but because that's the community that I, you know, represent, I have to speak on our behalf. But there is a challenge. We know that there are a number of young people that's out there. They're being exposed to going to college. They're being told about careers in the military. But when it comes to construction, I constantly hear that that's not something that they're told is a career option while they're in high school or in college. And we need to change that conversation.
Are you finding that that through your efforts working with the City of Gary in particular, that the skilled trades are in turn getting their apprenticeship programs supported as well? Or is this something that you're working especially hard for the City of Gary, but it seems to be narrowed down to the fact that none of the trades are getting all the apprentices they'd like to have?
Well, it's a well, first of all, let me say I'm very proud to have the support of my executive director and the mayor to ensure that local Gary residents and local Gary contractors are provided employment and contracting opportunities on our projects. Mm-hmm. So I'm fortunate in that regard to have that high level of support. In regards to the apprenticeships, it is a challenge, but we do have a good line of communication and working relationship with the apprenticeship coordinators of nearly every trade. We have a good relationship on the journeyman side and speaking with many many of the business agents. So it is a collective effort of trying to get more, particularly minorities and women, involved into the construction trades.
We know this is an effort that the overall Center for Workforce Innovation is trying to support. They've been trying to get the word out, I know, and get all the trades together. Do you think that this is going to be a problem? Are you finding that the efforts that the state is having to try to boost more people involved in going into the trades as opposed to going into college and helping get you off in the right direction?
Well, you know, we have a good relationship working with Linda Woloshansky. I've known her for years, love working with her. And last year, the Center for Workforce Innovation, the Work One Centers, and the Construction Advancement Foundation, they held a hands-on construction trades career fair at the Lake County Fairgrounds. And it was widely supported by nearly every school in Lake and LaPorte County. And so it's those types of initiatives that's needed to expose our children to the actual trades. The hands-on allowed them to get a feel for what it means to be an electrician, what it means to be a technical engineer, what it means to be an iron worker. So that type of hands-on exposure is very critical. But it is, again, it's a collective effort. So where the state is trying to go in regards to apprenticeships begins with making sure that all the communities in Northwest Indiana are made aware of the careers in construction. And I emphasize careers because it's not just about working in the field. Mm-hmm. They need project managers. They need people that are in the marketing. You know, so there are all types of career opportunities in construction. I just think that our school system could do a more aggressive job in letting high schoolers know that there are other careers in construction.
Do you think that this is just another project that, in particular, the Gary Community Schools, although they have their own issues to deal with, that they're trying to help make sure that young people across the city of Gary and the region as well know that these are job opportunities that are out there, these are career opportunities that are out there?
Absolutely. Everybody's got things that's going on. I mean, it's just the nature of the beast in our country right now. But I think that in terms of our school corporation, they still have a responsibility in terms of educating our children, educating them with the textbook, but also educating them with career options. And so to the degree that we can ensure that they are made aware of, if they educate and more, you know, inform the students that there are careers in construction. Some students, you know, may not feel so lost in terms of having options if they don't want to go to college. And for those who aren't interested in going into the military, they could see construction because there's good paying jobs. I mean, some people in construction make up more than $100,000 a year. And so those salaries and wages, they need to be made aware of.
Tammy Davis is the Director of Compliance and Project Engagement for the Sanitary District in Gary and the Stormwater Management District in Gary. And thank you for spending time with us to talk about your particular needs and how you are trying to work with all the other trades, in particular in Northwest Indiana, to get young people involved and educated as well. And we hope that you'll be back with us again soon to bring us updates and keep us informed as to what at least the Sanitary District and the Stormwater Management District are doing to be able to get the people to be able to get these projects done. Thanks for being with us today.
Absolutely. Thank you, Chris.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us today. Tomorrow, we'll learn more about RISE Northwest Indiana and their education campaigns ahead of the November general election. Hope you'll join us.